Hello and welcome to the Extronics Hazardous Area IoT podcast. My name is Stuart Milne and I'll be your host for the podcast. Today I'm joined by CEO and founder of Extronics, John Hartley, and I'm also joined by Nick Saunders, Operations Director at Extronics, and our guest, Sean Clark, Managing Director of EX Veritas. Welcome, everyone.
Welcome.
Hello.
Yeah, nice to see you.
Sean, I wonder if you would mind giving our listeners a brief introduction to EX Veritas and your role there.
Certainly, and thanks for inviting me along. EX Veritas are a group of companies in the UK, Europe and America who specialise in explosion safety certification. We're a UK CA government appointed body in the UK, which is of course the new scheme post-Brexit for EX certification in the UK, an ATEX notified body, that's in Denmark in the EU, and an IECX certification body and test laboratory. We also do NRTL listing via MET from our Dallas office and follow-up service audits, more of which I'm sure will be discussed later. My role in the company, I tend to check certificates, final documents before they're issued, and I occasionally act as an expert witness in court cases and arbitrations, which are necessary when things go wrong. And it's interesting to note that these sort of cases could easily be prevented if people involved understood their obligations to the field. It's certainly very expensive to sort out after the fact.
Yeah, I can imagine. Oh, that's great. Thanks for the for giving us a little bit of your background. On today's podcast, we're going to be talking about a commonly misunderstood area around hazardous area wireless installations. As an end user, can you buy and install non-certified wireless equipment inside a pre-certified hazardous area enclosure yourself? The misunderstanding around this question and what you can and cannot do under global EX directives and health and safety legislation. So let's dive in. John, coming to you first, could you start by setting the scene here for our listeners and explaining why you think as an EX wireless enclosure manufacturer, Extronics comes across this misunderstanding so often?
Yeah, absolutely. So perhaps it makes sense that I just explain a little bit what a pre-certified wireless enclosure is and why there's a demand. Well, there's a lot of wireless technology out there, and customers are wanting to use the latest generation of technology and deploy it into potentially explosive atmospheres. Generally speaking, you find that tech companies are not into hazardous area EX certification. So there's a big lag between new technology becoming available and maybe a hazardous area version of it being certified so that you can deploy it in a refinery or an oil and gas platform or a hazardous area chemical plant. So basically, we have a range of enclosure systems that are pre-certified either for Zone 2 or Division 2 or Zone 1 and Division 1 for deployment into those two different types of hazardous areas. And they're pre-configured with different options to allow you to install all types of wireless device that isn't EX certified without needing to get it certified, because the enclosure itself provides the certification. So that's what they are. And the sort of things companies are wanting to deploy are things like Wi-Fi, BLE, ultra wideband, location systems, UHF RFID, LTE routers. There are other things as well, but they're the common wireless technologies. So ideally, customers would love to install the wireless device themselves rather than have to send it to us or actually have us purchase that wireless device for them. And we understand why they want to do this, because a lot of our business is export. So if you're the other side of the world, you don't really want to be sending that device to us across the Atlantic, for instance, yeah, for us to then fit it into the enclosure, because there's a hassle to this. There's also costs and potentially duty implications managing this sort of import-export side. So we offer a procurement service where we actually buy the wireless device, but even that sometimes is not preferable. Maybe they get a special deal with the wireless vendor. So cost can be a problem there, or often we're working with the wireless system integrator channel. So they actually get special agreements or special discounts by the volume of business that they place with a particular vendor. So that sort of goes against that, which is why you see this coming up. And frankly, you can't easily do that. I mean, we're going to go into some detail today about why and what the options are and things like that. But so often we get asked, why can I not do this? Why can't I fit this myself? And when we explain, it's amazing how some are going, but I've been doing it for years with vendor X. And it's very difficult. You've got to be a bit careful in how you position this. But the bottom line is they're probably not doing it right. And it's not through willful sort of ignoring the rules. It's just basically probably more through ignorance. And it's the actual end user that is the one that ends up potentially getting something that's not fully compliant. So that's basically sort of where we're at and why we thought we'd get this podcast together to cover it in a bit more detail.
Yeah, that's great. Thanks for that, John. Sean, if I could come to you next. When we think about hazardous area wireless installations, it isn't just the manufacturer that has to consider compliance to these directives, but end users must also remain compliant. Perhaps you could give our listeners an overview of what drives the end users to comply to these directives and ensure that they are operating safely.
Yeah, certainly. It's always the end user's responsibility to operate safely, to ensure the equipment they've procured is the correct equipment and is installed correctly. There is a standard for this, which is widely used. It's an international standard, 60079-14, which is for installing any electrical equipment into a potentially explosive atmosphere. And that uses the term certification quite a lot in that standard. But I think it's important for people to realise that certification is a defined term within IEC standards, and it means third-party certification. That's what they're referring to. The term self-certification is something of an oxymoron, really, because you can't really issue yourself a certificate. You can self-attest, you can self-declare, but the certification process is really having somebody else, an independent, accredited, verified third party say something is correct. That's really what most end users are looking for or expecting. And it ticks a lot of boxes. The end users have a lot of responsibility under DSIR or PUR. These are the regulations and laws which insist that they check and ensure equipment is correct to protect the workers who are using that equipment. So buying certified equipment has always been the preferred route. And certified equipment is equipment which has been certified by the likes of Extronix or third parties who have been through an independent certification process. The problem with self-declaration or self-attestation is often the people who've undertaken the activity weren't qualified. They didn't know what they didn't know. They haven't undertaken training. It's quite a complicated subject. They're often not impartial. They're driven by deadlines and driven by other needs, commercial needs. Frankly, they may not be competent to make an assessment about whether something's correct or not. And they may not realise that they then, if they self-attest, are taking full legal responsibility for the equipment that they've installed. So all in all, it's better to use properly certified equipment. And you're much less likely to be challenged by inspectors or insurers or the health and safety executive. It can be difficult to demonstrate the competence required to do anything yourself internally versus just buying a piece of certified equipment. So that's really what drives certification, the use of certified equipment. There are some situations, where it is possible to risk assess equipment. The standard defines it as a fitness for purpose assessment, for example, where certified equipment isn't available. But that process is quite laborious. And again, the end user, the site, ends up taking all the risk. And the end user and the site can only undertake it if they have significant competence in certification, in the process of certification, which is unlikely.
Okay, and how does that differ for manufacturers who produce EX equipment? And perhaps you could explain some of the detail about the certification process here.
Yeah, well, the certification process, whatever it might be, in that, there are a number of schemes, ATEX, UKCA, IECX, but they're all pretty much following the same route, the same standards, the same necessities for the accredited certification bodies. It's usually a two-stage process. So we are sent a sample from the manufacturer, from the equipment manufacturer, and also a set of drawings. We test the sample to prove that the product is safe. But what we actually certify is the certification drawings, because normally the manufacturer wants to make more than one of these. If they're only making one of them, there is a route called unit verification where we can certify that actual unit because we've seen it by serial number. But in the vast majority of cases, they're going to want to go into production. So what we actually certify are what we call the schedule drawings. So the certificates that we ultimately issue will have a set of drawings listed on the certificate. Only what is covered on those drawings is covered by the certificate. The only people who will know what's on those drawings is the manufacturer, the OEM manufacturer. The end user will never have those drawings. They're the manufacturer's IP, which is why only the manufacturer can say whether something can or can't go inside a box. In terms of the actual testing, the internal layout, the internal geometry, and the power that a piece of equipment may dissipate inside a box will all have been tested by specific type testing. It's empirical testing. So we've only tested certain equipments of certain types in certain orientations. So even changing something that may appear like for like, or substituting something, you know, from vendor X to vendor Y, it might dissipate slightly more watts. It might have more internal volume. It might have a slightly different geometry. All of these things would invalidate the certification. So everything that's going to be inside a box or on a product which is certified has to be listed on the schedule drawings. All of those drawings are controlled drawings and can't be changed. And the manufacturer must manufacture to those drawings. Okay. So that's the first thing to realize. It's very controlled. In order for them to manufacture that product, they need a second certificate, which is referred to as a quality assurance notification or a quality assurance registration. Or for America, they do what's called a follow-up service audit, where they actually look at the products. But all of these types of things are on the factory that produces the equipment. Okay, so one way or another, the factory or factories that makes the equipment will be audited. They will be audited periodically. It varies from four times a year for the North American systems to yearly or every 18 months for ATEX and IECEX. But they have to have rigorous checks that they are following the drawings, that they are only manufacturing what they have certified, and that all tolerances, all checks have been carried out, all pre-tests have been carried out, all routine tests have been carried out. So they need those two certificates to place a product on the market. So the end customer can be assured that the type of product that was originally tested has been verified by an accredited, recognized third party, and that that is the actual product that they have received. That's what's been manufactured and that's what's been received. That's why the certification scheme is so important.
That's great. Thanks for that insight, Sean. Nick, if I can come to you next, how do we apply the relevant frameworks as a manufacturer then?
So Sean mentioned there a standard or a certificate that is issued against a manufacturer's quality system. So the particular standard that we follow there for ATEX and IECX is 8079-34, which is very much based on the ISO 9001 standard. It's quite well aligned, but there are many extra requirements on a manufacturer, you know, for example, of controlling and selection of suppliers or control of calibrated equipment, for example. There are some, you know, real specific things that a manufacturer would need to do. So some of the things that we would do above and beyond maybe what an ISO 9001 manufacturer would do is we are very specific about inspection of incoming goods and being very specific about what should be on a circuit board or a particular makeup of an enclosure, specifying the material, etc. Very focused on people's skills and competencies. You know, that's a big part of this, even though you do have the manufacturing drawings that Sean talked about. Making sure that your people are trained and are competent to do this, and you know, a regular assessment of that. Ensuring the suppliers that you've selected are fit for purpose and, you know, are monitored. And, you know, the other big part of this is ensuring there's defined processes for putting things together and testing along the way, because there's sometimes you can't actually test or visually inspect something because it might be encapsulated or potted, for example. So, you know, kind of in summary, inspection, auditing, skills and competency, and, you know, people and suppliers.
And is there any difference with regard to North America in that approach?
So if we think about North America, we think about the United States, for example, Sean mentioned about the NRTL scheme, where most of the states in the US are following something called the NFPA 70 regulations, which is the National Fire Protection Association. So this is a set of guidance about how electrical equipment is installed and selected for use in hazardous environments. And within that document, there's an article 110, which talks about listed or tested equipment shall be used. And the kind of most common way is that equipment is selected on its listing. And what it talks about a listing there, this is again the third party assurance and certification of product. So again, under the NRTL scheme, is widely recognised that there's a number of bodies, UL, Met Labs, FM, Intertek, etc., have these accreditations and can issue these certificates. But as part of that, your factory or the factories that are putting together this equipment also have to be approved. Now, the difference here between the IECX and the ICX ATEX and the North American scheme is that audit is quarterly. And again, it is based on the ISO 9001 regulations, but it's very much looking at the materials, incoming goods, how are you assuring that those parts meet the requirements of your certificate drawings, looking at calibration, those kind of things, kind of on top and above of ISO 9001. And I think a couple of things that are important here. One is around when a piece of equipment has a listing. This is like a piece of equipment that you would use in its entirety. So think about maybe an enclosure that had a defined purpose. It had a particular piece of equipment or a particular wireless device in it, or you know, set of power supplies or something. Then you have something that's like a recognized components as part of the scheme, and what that's basically is that only certain attributes to that. So a good example of that would be something like a power supply that you might have assessed for its characteristics, that, you know, it's made of certain material, its flammability, its power dissipation, its performance under temperature, etc. And then there's a third category, which is what's called classified, where this is often used around enclosures. So like think about it like what would be called a flame proof or explosion proof enclosure in the United States, where that enclosure has been tested with certain limits, i.e. certain geometries fitted inside it, certain pressures, certain temperatures, etc. And it's also very important when we talk about classified products, is how they're marketed and what the limitation of the testing was. It was only tested, you know, with this geometry or this particular thing in size. So typically that's how the scheme is kind of different.
Yeah. Is that, Nick, just sorry to jump in there, is that similar then to a U component certificate then in the ATEX IECX type terminology?
Yes, it is very similar, but it does allow you to go a little further to say you could test a certain geometry inside.
Right. So
what's going on with a component certificate, you would test it only, you know, there's the very specific test that would be done around it being empty. Yeah. So this could be empty, or it could have part.
But I think there's a similar. Yeah, I think there's a similar reason that those type of enclosures exist, though, isn't there? And that is to allow OEMs to buy effectively a part certified part. Yeah. to save them having to do it all themselves. And especially when you're a niche manufacturer and the volumes aren't high, things get very expensive. So actually, if you can get part certified things, that's really useful, because you then go to a certification body, yeah, to get the complete certificate for your overall assembly. And what we're also finding and noticing is that these enclosures are the things that are being bought. They are part certified effectively. Yeah.
I think what's important as well is there's something else to mention, which is some of the NRTL laboratories also have certified panel shop schemes. So UL have one for exactly what you're describing there, John, where somebody would take a certain manufacturer's enclosure, deliver it to a specific panel shop that was audited and tested and had their accreditation, and they were able to put in NRTL listed recognized parts that were specified on a certificate and actually produce a piece of listed equipment.
Right. Okay. Makes a lot of sense, that, Nick. Yeah. Get it.
Yeah. So clearly there are quite a few hurdles that both the end user and the manufacturer must clear to remain compliant here. I guess it's sort of a question to the whole group, thinking about that misunderstanding and what you can and can't install yourself under these directives. Where does the responsibility fall for conformity once the product is placed on the market?
It's the end user, whoever's going to use the equipment. Let me take the European legislation, the UK legislation, for example, where we have it under law, so it's a lot more specific, and the requirements are clearly more documented. The end user has to protect the people in the working environment. So the requirement for installing certified equipment selecting equipment, I believe they're correct terminology, they have to select equipment on the basis of the category, also known as the EPL. This is the category 1, 2, and 3 for ATEX, or EPL, GA, GBGC, for example, for IEC, the rest of the world. That all falls down onto the end user. So the end user covers his back by buying certified equipment, third party certified equipment. That's how they can tick that box, and that one requirement goes away. They still have to install it correctly. They still have to inspect it correctly with periodic inspections and so on and so forth. And there are a whole suite of standards, 14, 17, 19, which are applicable to the end user. Once the manufacturer has applied their standards, which is a completely different suite of standards for product certification, it is not expected, and it would be very, very rare for the end user to understand the product certification standards. They are a separate specialist area. The manufacturers have to understand, and that's where they have to have their competence. It is extremely unlikely that the end user would have the competence to undertake any form of certification, self-certification, or even self-attestation. Even following a partially populated box instruction can be extremely difficult when you realize that you can't put certain things in, like perhaps batteries or RF devices or intrinsically safe devices or anything that rotates, or there's a whole series of rules, which unless you'd undertaken some fairly specialist training, you just couldn't possibly know these rules, and you'd have to read hundreds of pages of standards to derive all of these rules, which is why they tend to separate out into different disciplines. The discipline for the equipment manufacturer to ensure the equipment's correct, and then the discipline for the equipment installer to ensure the equipment is selected correctly, installed correctly, and maintained correctly.
That's great. Thanks for that insight. I don't know if anyone else got anything to add to that, but I wanted to sort of ask a question around what an end user or a system integrator would need to do in order to install wireless equipment themselves. John, maybe you could pick that one up.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we've sort of slightly touched on it in Nick's comments. But let's just say we take a North American example. So there are really two possible scenarios. Basically, you would, if you wanted to install a wireless device, yeah, into a hazardous area in an enclosure system, a pre-certified enclosure system, first of all, you really need to find one that is completely certified and listed. Yeah, that's the normal route, so that it's got a listing, or in ATEX and IACX terms, if we were doing it over there, would have the appropriate EX apparatus certificate. So back into the North American area, they would send that piece of equipment, the non-certified wireless device, to a company like Extronics, who's got a pre-certified enclosure system, and we would assess that piece of equipment to make sure that it meets the certificate limitations, the allowances, the certificate schedules, as they're called, and we ensure that it is compliant and meets all the required standards. And of course, the basic things like, will it fit? Well, it might look like it'll fit, but there are rules of things, how close it can be to the edge of the enclosure and things like that. Again, from a heat generation point of view under fault. And there's so much, as Sean said, detail that has to be paid attention to that isn't sort of obvious. And that's obviously all there, and the manufacturer knows that on the certificate. Now, as we've said, that's sometimes hassle and inconvenience, call it what you like, and not acceptable to users. So us as a manufacturer, we provide a procurement service, and we don't look to, make commercial gain on procuring that wireless device. We just do that to make it easy for the customer. And then, of course, they don't have the hassle. We get it, we install it, same process. The sort of third way of going about this is, and it, this is where it touches on similar to what Nick was saying, like there are UL panel shops. So these are certified locations with the required competencies and skills to be able to safely install and work to a set of manufacturer's instructions. Yeah. To ensure that the end device that is installed in the hazardous area is compliant to all the standards. So this is a little similar to how the explosion-proof enclosure market works. The large companies have, they might not be a UL panel shop, for instance, but they would have their own approved workshops. They're not necessarily the same company, it could be a third party, but they're auditing them themselves. They have a defined, detailed process, and they often basically want complete details of everything that's going inside, full design drawings, all the declarations against the master certificate schedules, power and heat calculations, data sheets, lots of documentation that then gets assessed. And the final part of control that they have, other than the regular auditing and so on, is the actual EX rating plate label has to be then sent to them. Yeah. Once they are satisfied that that assembly with photographic documentary evidence meets the requirements of the certification, and that then gets sent, and then that third party workshop can then install that. Because the actual putting the rating plate, the EX rating plate, on the piece of equipment is basically you going, that's fit for purpose to go into a hazardous area based on the EX coding. And if it was in North America, though, us as a manufacturer, we can't just do the auditing. As was sort of said earlier, that's got to be done by the actual certification body who did the original certification. It's the facility itself. So think about it from the practicality. We've talked about end users, but what we're meaning is not the OEM, not the EX certificate holder. A lot of third-party system integrators and things like that, who then sell on to an end user. But can you think and imagine about having your workshop audited four times a year? Yeah, or just that batch of equipment being audited, because you can do a batch approval as well. It's sort of more trouble, yeah, and more hassle and more costly than actually allowing the enclosure, the pre-certified enclosure vendor, to provide that service for you. But we're just being straight here that it's not impossible. But what I'm saying is that buyer beware. Buyer beware, because those who are just putting things into enclosures, please look very carefully at the EX conformity certification, because probably you could well be buying something that is only effectively a classified or component approved type solution, so it's not fully compliant. And as Sean has clarified, it's the end user who's the one that has to ensure overall compliance of their facility and provide a safe working environment within the regulatory frameworks that there are out there. So that's why we say buyer beware. Ignorance is bliss until something goes wrong.
Yeah, there certainly is. And I think it's great that we've gone through some of those nuances. I think it's good to sort of clarify those points and kind of shed a bit of light on some of those misunderstandings.
What we didn't want to do, or I didn't want to do, is make out that you can't buy an empty enclosure. That's very normal practice. But it's not the job of the enclosure manufacturer who is selling an EX enclosure. It's got a legitimate component certificate with it. So they're not going to question everybody who wants to buy one of those. Yeah, but the companies out there that are buying them and then putting things in and selling them on as if they're completely certified, well, they're sort of rogues, really, in my opinion. Yeah, so we just want to be straight about that it's not that you can't buy enclosures on their own with nothing in. That's normal practice. We do. We don't make everything ourselves.
Yeah, certainly. Well, gentlemen, thank you so much for your input today. And thank you again, Sean, for joining us and providing your expertise and insights. We hope you found the content of today's discussion useful. Please follow us on LinkedIn, where we'll be posting all of the latest podcasts and lots of other useful content for you to access. And if you do have any questions for any of the speakers today on the podcast, then please get in touch by emailing us on info@extronix.com, or you can visit our website, www.extronix.com, where you can find all of our contact information. Thank you for listening, and please join us again soon for another edition of the Hazardous Area IoT podcast.